Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 6 weeks ago, Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, was scheduled to come on this show to talk about a controversy that was raging among environmentalists over how to reach a 100% renewable future. Richard lives in Santa Rosa, and when I contacted him a week before the show was supposed to be on, parts of Santa Rosa were on fire and he and his wife had evacuated. He had no electricity, no internet, and I didn't want to put any pressure on him to do an interview the following week with so much uncertainty hanging in the air. Now the wine country fires are out and Richard is on the line, but today, instead of talking about the original topic, we're going to look at how all the disasters we've witnessed this year are highlighting critical lessons about what it means not only to build a sustainable future, but one that is resilient as well. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Good to be speaking with you again.
Yes, it's fine. Glad to finally get you on here. I want to make sure, am I right that the fires are out now? It's been a while, but...
Oh, yeah. Sonoma County is in recovery mode now. And, you know, it's been a traumatic experience, particularly, of course, for the thousands of people who lost their homes. Something like 6,000 dwellings, you know, were torched over a week-long period of intense wildfires. And so, you know, the city has lost part of its tax revenue. There are all kinds of efforts going on to provide services to folks who have lost all their possessions, and it's really an interesting time to be here.
Well, I want to talk today on two levels. This, first of all, the personal level, and then also we can talk about the kind of the larger political, geopolitical level of what we're experiencing with the kinds of disasters that we're seeing coming quickly on the heels of one another. But I wanted to start with your personal response. You wrote a very interesting blog, which people can find. There's a link to it on our website, on the Locus Focus website. But you start out by saying, disaster is always something that happens to other people.
Right.
So what do you mean by that?
I know there are exceptions to this, but typically most people don't prepare adequately for the kinds of disasters that we all know are entirely possible. And more preparation makes an enormous difference in how you're able to respond and maintain basic functionality. You know, we had a disaster kit. We had stuff. We had gallons of water set aside in case of earthquake, and we had bug out bags and all these things. And they helped when the time came to evacuate. But you know, we realized that our disaster kits were way out of date. You know, we got out our wind up radios and discovered that the batteries were completely dead. No matter how much you wound them, they wouldn't work, and other things like that. So, I'm a person who talks about disaster all the time. I've been for years talking about community resilience and the kinds of economic and environmental disasters that we are setting up for ourselves as modern societies. So, you know, I think we were probably better prepared than most people. A lot of folks escaped with the clothes on their backs and nothing else. I guess the point is that you know, we are setting ourselves up for financial, energy, climate disasters, and we have a short window of time in which to build resilience ahead of these disasters. And they're not necessarily going to occur all at once in one, you know, big fell swoop, but just with an increasing frequency and persistence of crises like wildfires, droughts, extreme weather phenomena and bank crises and banking crises like we had in 2008 and so on. And, you know, the time to prepare, I mean, it's kind of an obvious oxymoron, but the time to prepare is ahead of time. Once the crisis is upon you, you're just in reaction mode. And this is something we're finding here in Sonoma County. You know, we have the opportunity now to rebuild in a way that is more resilient ahead of future disasters. And everyone is still in crisis mode. So the uppermost priority in everyone's mind is just getting back to normal, whatever that looks like to them, to those people. And so very little thought is going into how we can rebuild in a way that makes it easier for us to make it through the next disaster and to make the next disaster less severe in the first place.
Well, you talk about getting back to normal. I was going to ask you at the beginning of the show, I was going to ask you if things are back to normal, and I thought, I don't even know what that question means, so I decided not to ask it. But, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, is there any way that we can get back to normal, or do we even want to get back to normal?
Well, see, that really gets to the heart of this whole discussion, because in most people's minds, normal is a way of life that is, you know, absolutely extraordinary in any kind of historical or cross-cultural terms. Normal is shopping at big box stores. Normal is driving a gasoline-burning car. Normal is buying all your food at the store. Normal is not knowing your next-door neighbors. Normal is sitting and or walking around for hours every day looking at a little glowing screen or a big glowing screen rather than interacting directly with your environment. I mean, all of this is just, you know, completely unprecedented in all of previous human history. And we take it for granted that this is not only a normal way of living now, but it's how future generations necessarily should live as well. But you start taking apart what are the energy resource requirements that enable this normal way of life, and what are its impacts on the environment, and you quickly realize that what we call normal is completely unsustainable. It's a setup for the kinds of disasters that we've been talking about, financial, economic, and environmental. So, yeah, that good question.
Well, I actually had an interesting personal experience in responding to the fire, and particularly in responding to your being caught up in it and the inability. You emailed me that, you know, you had no internet, you had no phone, you had no Skype. And at the time, our internet, our email provider had basically melted down, and we had no, and it happened a week before the fire started, and I was in the process of, like, I changed internet email providers, and I was, like, dealing, the thing that was amazing to me was I realized when I had to change my email address, how much of my identity was hung up on that email address, and right. It was really scary, because I changed an email address 20 years ago, and it was no big deal at all. You know, you let, you know, your friends know, but now every bit of business that you do is connected to that email address. So I was, like, you know, bemoaning it, complaining to my friends, and then I got the email from you, and I thought, oh, I thought I had problems, but you know, I mean, I realized, but it made me think two things, because I mean, my problem was, like, really minuscule compared to thinking about what was going on in Sonoma and in Napa counties, but also thinking that we are so technologically dependent on all these things that go away so quickly when we have a disaster, that it sort of made me think that much more about the dangers that we're in on that kind of technological dependency.
Yeah, what you just said brought to mind for me that classic book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, by archaeologist Joseph Tainter, published in the late 1980s. It was one of the key books on the process of societal collapse that we've seen in history, you know, going back to the beginning of complex societies a few thousand years ago. And he argued that complexity is at the core of society's problem-solving strategies. In other words, we have a problem as a society, and we become more complex in order to solve that problem through technology, through increasing social complexity, making you know more distinction between social classes and more job descriptions and so on. And absolutely, we've done that, especially over the course of the last century or so. We've grown our societies in scale and our technologies in complexity and so on. And we've solved a lot of problems. You know, we've been able to grow more food to feed more people and spread wealth around and so on. But his point is that this is a strategy that is subject to the law of diminishing returns, and that's what's gotten previous complex societies. Also, complexity requires more energy, and so as long as you have more energy to deploy more complexity to solve more problems, then you know things go along okay. But beyond a certain point, it becomes difficult for societies to acquire enough energy to maintain the complexity they have, and that's when things start to come apart. And you know, you look at the way we solve problems today. Sometimes you know we solve problems with energy efficiency, and that seems like a good thing. You know, trading out our old incandescent lights for LED lights. We've done that in our cities, and you know, cities have saved tons of money with their street lights. But now there's just a study came out a few days ago showing how what we've done with that energy savings and money savings is to produce more light. We're you know we're putting up stronger street lights and more lights, so we're lighting more area and lighting it brighter. And in the end, we're spending as much money on lighting, and we're driving the nighttime away, so that creatures that depend on darkness, you know, can't navigate, and human beings can't sleep as well at night. And you know, we've made our problems that much worse.
Actually, we have one of those LED streetlights right outside of a bedroom window, and we used to complain because our neighbor had this tree that blocked the light, so we couldn't see walking down our path at night. It was in the days when it was an incandescent light bulb, and then, the tree actually got cut down finally, and they changed out the lights, and suddenly we can't sleep at night. But it's a kind of, and it's interesting to see like where we go with like wanting the protection we think that, for instance, that night lighting has, and not understanding that there's a real reason why it's dark at night.
Right. And of course, one of the things that we've done with regard to complexity in our society is we have built it into our economic system, the desire for continually for more complexity, and we call that economic growth. And it's an inherent tenet of modern capitalism. The economy constantly has to grow in order to produce more jobs, more tax revenues for government, more profits for investors, and so on. And you know, as long as we have more energy available, it's possible to grow the economy. But beyond a certain point, it's not going to be possible to continue growing the economy forever. I mean, we live on a finite planet. So at some point, we reach that point of marginal diminishing returns that Painter talked about, and the thing starts to come apart. Now, this is not just being cynical about things and being a pessimist. It's utter realism. And so how should we be preparing for that? How should we be acting as a society in order to reduce the inevitable trauma that will come when we reach that point of diminishing returns, that point of, you know, where we can't solve our problems just by growing anymore.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heimberg, who is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and author of 13 books and myriad articles, and probably best known in a lot of circles for talking about peak oil early on. But Richard has also been doing a lot of thinking about resiliency, particularly in the wake of what he experienced with the Santa Rosa fire last month. I was thinking how there's been this interesting pattern this summer, and there's these weird pairings of catastrophes. And there was Hurricane Harvey, and it was just kind of mind-blowing to watch that much of Houston underwater, as mind-blowing as watching New Orleans underwater in 2005. And then shortly after Harvey, then we had this big fire in the Columbia Gorge that was set by teenagers throwing firecrackers into a canyon, and that was a pretty scary event for those of us. Well, actually, it was one of many big fires that was burning all around the Northwest, and we had intense ash and smoke in the air in Portland for days and days, and it was. And then was also a lot of concern about the danger of the fire itself. Then after that, we had this pairing of the fires in wine country and Hurricane Maria hitting Puerto Rico. And I wonder if we could kind of look at these, let's just take those four incidences of the impact of, we'll say the cause of these disasters, and so much of it I think we can probably attribute to some degree to climate change, but the cause, the impact, the response to it, and looking particularly at the difference between the experience that Puerto Rico had after Hurricane Maria and what the stateside regions had after the two fires and Hurricane Harvey.
Right. Yeah, I haven't been back to Puerto Rico since the hurricane struck there. I was there just a few years ago on a speaking engagement and was able to meet number of government officials. I spoke in the Puerto Rican Senate, and I was invited by the sustainability program at the university there. So I was able to gain some appreciation for, you know, how the island works economically. And it was a perilous situation then before the hurricane. I mean, the power sector is basically a private company, electrical power, that is completely dysfunctional and corrupt. And the island's economy has been declining for years. It's been losing population. People there can simply up and move to the mainland U.S. without having to go through any legal rigmarole. So a lot of folks have been doing that. And now, of course, since the hurricane, many more have been opting to move. And this is a real turning point for the island there. There are many people who are saying, you know, this is the opportunity to go back and do it right, you know, to get rid of PREPA, which is the electric power utility, or at least reform it very substantially. A lot of electricity was being generated with imported bunker oil or diesel fuel, which is about the most inefficient and expensive way of generating electricity you can imagine in today's world. Why not, you know, put in more renewable energy? Why not make it a more, you know, resilient power system so that the same thing doesn't happen again? But once again, as we were saying earlier, the priorities seem to be to just get the power up back on as quickly as possible using current equipment, and make a lot of money doing so. Some of the companies that have been brought in to help get electricity back to people's houses are, profiteering, I should say, on the situation. And it's back to the famous disaster capitalism that that we've seen in so many natural disasters around the world. So I'm sorry to say so, but I think things in Puerto Rico are still pretty dire and not going in a very good direction right now. Where you do see good news in Puerto Rico, it's the people themselves on the ground who are banding together to provide basic necessities for their communities, and often small communities. And they are often sort of leftist networks that already existed that are, you know, connecting people to one another and making sure everybody gets something to eat, getting back to growing food locally. Most of Puerto Rico's food for the last number of years has been, the vast majority of it has been imported, just because that's the best way to make the commercial sector rich. But of course, it's a very non-resilient way to feed people, is just to import everything from the mainland. So there is good news in Puerto Rico, but very little of it has to do with the government or with the U.S. federal government response.
Well, I was reading your blog post about Puerto Rico, and one of the responses to it was commenting on how Puerto Rico is an island, and so everything, that all their help has to come from the mainland, basically.
Right.
And it was comparing it to like Santa Rosa, where your help came. Well, I was watched that video that you linked to in one of your articles of the three that was made by three Berkeley firefighters who came up with their crew to help put out the fire in Santa Rosa, or one of the fires. And so you, in Santa Rosa, you were getting help from all around the Bay Area. People were coming in. But what happens when we have collapses that are on a much larger scale? When there's no outside to come in, let's say.
Right. Yes. An excellent point. And that brings us back to what I was saying about Puerto Rico, where the most effective responses are being organized by the people themselves at the local level. And I think we're going to find that increasingly as disasters take place. We're going to be seeing less and less recovery organized at larger, you know, state and federal levels. And more will be left up to local networks of people, which makes it that much more important that we begin to establish those networks ahead of time. When you go through a disaster, you very quickly realize that your most important resource is your connection with the people around you. Here in Santa Rosa, during the fires, you know, we didn't have power. Our neighbors didn't have power. So the first thing we did was get out and start talking to our neighbors, and our refrigerators, you know, were, all the food was starting to go bad. So we all got together and had evening feasts of our food that was that would otherwise go to waste. And my wife and I have solar panels on the roof of our house and a battery backup system. So we should have had electricity, but our system failed for some reason. It turned out one of our neighbors is an engineer, and he has a friend who's a solar engineer, and he got his friend over, and they were just curious what was wrong with our system, and they spent a couple of hours tracking down what the problem was, got us electricity going again. And, you know, we couldn't have done that without help of our neighbors. And there, I could tell you story after story, not just of ourselves, but folks we know here in Santa Rosa who maybe lost their homes and are now staying with friends across town, or were able to, you know, rely on connections that would help, you know, feed and house them during the time of crisis. That's our most important resource, and we've been squandering it as a society for the last few decades, as we've built up this consumer culture where we depend not on our neighbors and friends and relatives, but we depend on the commercial structures around us to supply all our needs. It's normal and natural that we do that, given the context we find ourselves in, but it makes us much more vulnerable in the kinds of situations that we're talking about.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who is a senior fellow at Post Carbon Institute and has written extensively about peak oil and other crises that we are facing. Let's talk a little bit about what has brought us to this point where we're having all these catastrophes. Because when we talk about mitigation and we talk about creating resilience, which is obviously a very important thing to be talking about in the face of climate change, sometimes I get uncomfortable that we're not talking enough about doing whatever we can to stop the worst ravages of climate change from actually taking
Absolutely.
Place.
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with regard to economic growth. We have created the problem of climate change, of course, because of our reliance on fossil fuels, carbon energy sources. But you look at the history of our relationship with fossil fuels, and it started fairly recently, actually, just in the last 150 years here in the United States, and it's increased year after year as a result of our demanding more and more economic growth. So we've used more fossil fuels to grow the economy, and as the economy grows, it requires more energy, and most of that energy comes from fossil fuels. Well, now we find ourselves at this crossroads where we're facing a global ecological catastrophe, i.e. climate change, and it seems to demand of us that we end our reliance on fossil fuels as quickly as possible. But how do we do that? Our leaders, of course, want more economic growth, and that's their first priority, but they don't want the crisis of climate change. So what's the solution? Well, there must be a technological solution, everyone assumes. Unplug the coal power plant, plug in a solar panel, and then theoretically we should be able to continue doing what we were doing before, growing the economy, making more jobs, and so on. But it's not really that easy. I think what we were going to be talking about originally in this interview was a book that I co-wrote with David Fridley of who's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He's part of the energy analysis program there. We looked at the prospects for 100% renewable energy, and the result was a book called Our Renewable Future, which you can look up on the Internet. Oh, the whole content of the book is available for free on the Internet. And our conclusion was it's necessary. We've got to get off of fossil fuels. And one way or another, we are headed toward a renewable future, but it's not going to be the kind of economy that we've gotten used to. Why? Because renewable energy sources are fundamentally different in their characteristics from the fossil fuels that have energized our economy for the last several decades. Also, in addition to the intermittency of renewable energy sources, there's the need for the rapidity of the pace of transition, which means that in the early stages of the transition, we're not going to be building solar panels with energy from other solar panels. We're going to be doing it with energy from fossil fuels. So that means we're going to have to reduce, in order to avoid a pulse of carbon from the energy transition, which is a very big deal. The energy transition is going to require, you know, replacing most of the infrastructure of modern industrial societies. So it's a huge project, and it's going to take a lot of energy. So in order to avoid a pulse of carbon into the atmosphere from the energy transition itself, we're going to have to reduce the use of fossil fuels for all the things we're currently using them for, like, you know, flying to Las Vegas for the weekend, or keeping your house at 75 degrees during the winter, or, you know, I mean, the list is absolutely endless. But it's going to require a change in how we live. Unfortunately, we don't see this as a topic of discussion among policymakers or the general public. And it's one of the sticking points, I think, in people's understanding of where we are at this moment in history. If we take these things seriously, both the limitations of fossil fuels and the kinds of changes that we're going to have to make in transitioning to other energy sources, I think inevitably have to conclude that our current way of life is just is unsustainable. We have to start making other plans now, and making other habits in terms of how we live.
Well, I got a response to the email I sent out this week about this show and the topic about how do we go 100% renewable. And from this guy who's a really, really active environmental activist and been in the lead of trying to fight this oil terminal that is being proposed to be built in Vancouver, Washington, the North America's largest oil-by-rail terminal. So he emailed me about how he's gotten a lot of pushback from other environmental activists who don't want to be criticized for how much they fly. And there's one person in particular who says, I don't want to be made to feel guilty for flying as much as I do. And he was just kind of, I could just hear him or watch him shaking his head in the email. And I wonder, how do we address that? I mean, like Bill McKibben flies all over the place. And yeah, there's a major contradiction there. I used to fly a lot. I don't for a bunch of reasons right now. And I'm kind of really glad that I don't. But I'm afraid what would happen if I found myself in the position again where I needed to fly. So how do we resolve that kind of contradiction?
Yeah. That's a tough one, because aviation is one of the industries that's going to be hardest to transition away from fossil fuels. When we did our analysis for our renewable future, we looked at the various options being proposed, like sophisticated biofuels or concentrated supercooled hydrogen. Electric aircraft are probably a non-starter, just because the energy density of batteries is so low. It's an order of magnitude too low to enable, you know, airplanes to take off and fly with more than a couple of passengers. I mean, there are electric aircraft. They do exist already, but they, you know, they're basically intended for one or two passengers. So, yeah, it is an ethical problem. It's a practical problem. I've been reducing my reliance on aviation pretty steadily for the last few years. I do still fly occasionally when there's just no other way to accomplish something that it seems necessary. I sympathize with Bill McKibben. You know, I mean, his flying is for the purpose of making this fundamental policy shift that will, you know, hopefully in the end make flying obsolete as a result. But in the meantime, you know, it's how you get stuff done in the world as it is. So there's no easy way around that problem that I can see.
Well,
each of us has to make the decisions, those moral and ethical decisions, on a case by case basis. And I have a number of environmentalist friends who've just, you know, drawn the line and said they're not flying anymore. Period.
Well, I remember actually after 9/11, I was on the board of directors of Radio Federation, and we have we would have like at least annual board meetings in D.C. And after 9/11, we had a meeting like just a few weeks after 9/11, and most of us didn't want to fly. And this one guy who was based in Nebraska was like, "Well, I'm going to take the train." And those of us on the West Coast said, "Well, easy for you to say." And that was even like not thinking so much about the carbon footprint of airplanes just as much as just kind of the fear factor at that time. But it did kind of raise the point about it seems like we have to be like working towards creating another infrastructure that's an alternative to air travel. I mean, maybe it's high-speed trains or something that would maybe not get you there quite as fast as a plane would, but certainly a lot faster than our current rail or car systems.
Right, yeah. Well, that's one of the tragedies of how the U.S. has industrialized over the last 50 years. During the 1940s, we had a national rail service that was second to none. You could get from anywhere to anywhere else in the United States by rail, and now you can't. And many other countries not only have rail, but it's mostly electrified rail. Japan, for example, excellent passenger rail service, most of it's electrified. The point, of course, is that if you have electric rail, you at least have the option then of producing that electricity from renewable sources, and you have a more or less sustainable transportation system. Of course, then we get into how you build the tracks and the rail carriages and all that, and
they set wildfires and things like that too.
Yeah, right. But at least there's the possibility. But here in the U.S., we have prioritized personal vehicles and aviation, which are, from an energy standpoint, the least efficient modes of transport and the ones, in the case of aviation, that will be most difficult to electrify. We can, substitute out our personal automobiles for electric vehicles, EVs, and that's starting to happen. We would have been much better off if we hadn't become so dependent on personal motor vehicles in the first place, because we're stuck in a system that is inherently inefficient and problematic.
Well, it seems to me that the only way to get people out of their cars is to make it so totally unpleasant to drive that they will find the alternative, which would be public transportation. And in New York City, where when I grew up, I spent a lot of time in New York and lived there when I was in college. And you would be out of your mind. This is back in the late 60s to drive a car in New York, at least especially in Manhattan. Recently, my most recent trip to the Bay Area, which was just a few weeks ago, we were staying in the East Bay. We had an event we were had to be at in the city for one of the days we were there, and everybody told us, do not drive across the Bay Bridge. And we took BART, and it turned out to be not a great, it wasn't nearly as nice as it had been the last time I was on it. And it was better than driving for sure, but it still made me think that the other part of it is that BART, which used to be, I think, a really excellent high-speed mass transit, has been deteriorating, and it's now 45 years old and is showing signs of wear, and seems to be the same with the New York subway system. We're not even keeping up our urban mass transit to the point where people want to use them.
Right. Yeah, we invest our transit dollars in more highways, widening highways, rebuilding highways, more terminals and runways at airports and so on. These are decisions that get made at higher levels, and they have enormous repercussions that last for decades and decades. And then they lock us into decisions that then reproduce themselves. In other words, once we've locked ourselves into highways and airports, it's difficult to go back to rail. It's difficult to undo that dependency that we've built.
Well, one of the things I found interesting in your article about Puerto Rico was talking about how we're at this close to a tipping point where we're going to move from having disasters to having collapse. And what do you mean by that?
Right. Well, a disaster is something you recover from and get back to normal, hopefully. In the case of Puerto Rico, I don't know if that's going to be the result. But whereas collapse is a process, again, that we've seen historically in many complex human societies over the course of thousands of years, where the society doesn't get back to normal. Normal ceases to exist. There's a fundamental breakdown in business as usual. You know, we are seeing more and more disasters. The question is, are these leading up to a point where, you know, a point of no return, where we can't recover? And I fear that that's most likely the case, that we are headed toward a kind of collapse. Now, I think it's important again to see collapse in the terms that Joseph Tainter discussed in his book, where collapse is a reduction in the complexity of society, and that can occur in different ways. It can occur very quickly. It can be a controlled collapse. It can occur over a longer period of time. If we were smart as a society, what we would be aiming for is what Amory Lovins used to call a soft landing. In other words, with the understanding that we can't maintain our current unsustainable levels of energy consumption, materials usage, and so on, we would be planning for a reduction in the complexity of society. What would that entail? Well, it would entail replacing technology with people. In the simplest terms, it would mean using our own brains and muscles in situations where currently we rely on long supply chains, complex commercial structures, and so on. Like growing more of our own food, like knowing our neighbors better, like sharing more rather than going to the store and buying stuff. Like repairing things and knowing how to repair things rather than throwing them away and going out and buying replacements. That would be a rational response to the sort of cul-de-sac that we're headed toward right now. And, you know, there are communities and people all around the country and all around the world who are doing those things. They don't get a lot of press. There's not a lot of media attention to them. We feature a lot of them on our website, resilience.org, every day. But community organizations, intentional communities, cooperatives, these are present everywhere. Every town, city, state has examples of people who are wising up and doing these things. The local food movement is a great example. It's just that, you know, society as a whole hasn't wised up yet to the fact that this is where our future lies. And all the talk about artificial intelligence and the next generation of commercial airliners and robotics and so on, that's really just the flotsam that we're seeing in the wake of our society's capsizing.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who's a senior fellow with the Post Carbon Institute. And in the last part of the show, I wanted to maybe turn to a bit more of an optimistic take. You mentioned at the very beginning that the burning of so much of Santa Rosa is an opportunity, perhaps, to rebuild with resilience in mind. And you also mentioned that about Puerto Rico. And I was thinking about how a lot of talk about the Columbia Gorge fire has been about how the fire was actually really good for the ecosystem. It was time for the forest to burn, and this is an opportunity for the forest to clear out unhealthy trees and other plants and to kind of renew itself. So do you think there's an analogy there? It seems awfully painful to think about the burning of your town, you know, and just equating it to, like, well, forest fires are often very good things. I don't know if you can say that to somebody who just lost everything they ever owned. Yeah. But how do we use these opportunities? And actually, I'd like to throw Houston in there. I'm not sure how much you've thought about Houston and have read any articles, but I mean, Houston is a city that really needs to rethink itself in the wake of Harvey. Yep. So how do we use these disasters as an opportunity to rethink the way that we rebuild our communities?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are lots of opportunities there. There are opportunities from the standpoint of how we build our structures, our houses, and public buildings. Because the way we build them now, they're first of all energy hogs, and second, they're vulnerable in many cases to either earthquake or fire, needlessly vulnerable. There are a lot of very good architects around who have, you know, solved a lot of these problems. Often, building differently costs a little more, and you know, this I think is something that we're going to have to confront because we've gotten used to putting up structures in this country as quickly as possible to enclose as much space as cheaply as possible, and the result has been very unpleasant and very ugly. I was just in downtown Santa Rosa the other day looking around and thinking, you know, I should lead an architecture tour here in Santa Rosa. A lot of towns have architecture tours, Chicago and others. But here I think I would do a brutalist architecture tour because, you know, starting in the 1970s, so many really, really ugly buildings, the Federal Building, some of the banks downtown and so on, were put up that, you know, the shopping malls are very almost always in this category, where, you know, they were designed to enclose as much space as quickly as possible and to be built as cheaply as possible, and that dictated the architecture. And as a result, the architecture is hideous. And, you know, so if a fire clears away a good portion of town, isn't this an opportunity for us to think about what would be a beautiful town to live in? And often that means, well, it's not going to be the cheapest kind of building to put up. But if you think about it and you look at best practices around the world, it's possible to put up structures that are zero energy, that are super highly insulated, that are extremely comfortable, and also very beautiful, and that are resilient to the kinds of stresses like fire and earthquake that we have to worry about in this part of the world. So that's one opportunity that I think we have, is to rethink the built environment. Another opportunity that we have is our relationship with the landscape. Again, most of the structures that we build are designed to take advantage of available real estate in relation to existing roads and other infrastructure. But that more or less ignores the larger picture of, you know, where do fires like to burn periodically. It turns out that, you know, where the Santa Rosa fire, its path this year, was almost exactly the same as the path of another big fire back in 1964. Well, we didn't learn a valuable lesson back then as to where you should build and where you shouldn't build. And as a result, you know, we put a lot of people at risk. The same thing with earthquake. We know where earthquake faults are. And so we shouldn't be building hospitals right on top of earthquake faults. which is unfortunately exactly what has happened in Santa Rosa. Well, we have the opportunity right now to undo and redo some of those decisions, to not only to avoid fire pathways and earthquake faults, but to build in harmony with nature, rather than just in opposition to nature.
Well, another,
which is what we're doing now.
I mean, another thing was that fire in 1964 did a lot much, much less human and building destruction than the one this year, because right. Santa Rosa was a small town back in 1964. And exactly. This gets also to Puerto Rico. What about places that are too densely populated for what we call it the carrying capacity, but for what that landscape can handle? Is this an opportunity to rethink where populations are settled, and how do we do that in a way that's not Malthusian?
Well, of course, the right way to do that is with family planning and birth control, and having an understanding that the whole world is overpopulated right now, but particularly places that are extremely vulnerable. And so, what are we going to do in the years ahead and decades ahead as sea levels rise and cities around our coasts become inundated and people flee inland? What are we going to do as the southwestern states in America become desertified and overheated as a result of climate change, and people flee to where they can survive in the summer, where they can grow crops and so on? Folks in the Pacific Northwest could find themselves with lots of company.
We already are, actually. It's already happening.
So, if we're not going to be overrun in that way, then, we need to start thinking now about what the alternatives are, either to enable people to stay in place or to, first of all, reduce population growth so that fewer people are at risk in that way. And also so that fewer people are contributing to the problems of overuse of resources. But then also, how can we build our communities more resiliently wherever they are?
Well, Richard, it's always great to talk to you, and I'm thinking we could continue this conversation sometime in the near future and maybe answer some of the questions that you've raised today, because I feel like we've actually raised more questions than we've come up with answers.
Yeah, there's always more questions.
Right, so I'll kind of give you an assignment. Maybe you can come up with some answers for next time.
Okay.
Anyway,
good.
Thanks a whole lot for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Barbara.
And good luck with rebuilding Santa Rosa.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Richard Heinberg, who's a senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we're going to talk with Anna LaPay about the future of food. This is actually based on a special issue of The Nation that came out a few weeks ago, which she was the guest editor for. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Next week is going to be our pledge drive, so stay tuned for that and help support listener-sponsored community radio.
Chevrons of migrating geese scatter across a mottled sky, golden leaves fall from near naked trees, memories echo with a sigh. Along the crease, foretelling winter's start. Clouds of mirth shroud the sun, and just as soon they part, and everything is being born as things fall apart. Everything is being born as things fall apart. Partisans who can't give up the fight, balanced in the moment before everything has changed. It will never be the way we thought it always would remain. It will never be the way we thought it always would remain. Now it's time to make a move. Perched on a pinnacle, I see the shadows of what was and what will be.